So if you're just saying saturated fat is bad, you, to somebody who actually knows what they're talking about, you don't sound like you know what you're talking about.
Welcome to the Drew Perowit Podcast. Each week, we explore the inner workings of the brain and the body with one of the brightest minds in wellness, medicine, and mindset. Today, my guest is my dear friend, Max Lugavere. Max is a filmmaker, TV personality, and health and science journalist. He's most notably known for his authoring of the New York Times bestselling book, Genius Food: Become Smarter, Happier, and More Productive While Protecting Your Brain for Life. If there was an ideal guest for this podcast to talk about nutrition, it would be Max. Max knows so much about the body and the brain. And today we have him back on the podcast to celebrate his new book, Genius Kitchen, where he dives deep into 100 easy and delicious recipes to make your brain sharp and strong and taste buds happy. We're not talking recipes necessarily on here, but we are talking nutrition, and Max shines when it comes to the topic of nutrition. I think you're going to enjoy today's episode. Stay tuned. So if I had to pick one supplement that's made the biggest difference in my overall health, it would have to be magnesium. This super mineral is needed for over 400 different enzyme reactions in your body. And this is the thing, because you know I'm obsessed with sleep. It's so critical for your sleep, plus your heart, brain health, your muscles, and so much more. When you don't get enough magnesium, you can struggle with things like muscle twitches, insomnia, palpitations, constipation, migraines, and the list goes on and on. I personally started taking magnesium to help my sleep, especially when I travel, and it's been a game changer. But I don't just take any old magnesium. I take BioOptimizer's Magnesium Breakthrough. It contains seven different forms of magnesium, which all have different functions in the body. I haven't found anything else like it on the market. Honest to God. Magnesium Breakthrough can help reduce cortisol and stress, and it promotes deeper relaxation and helps with even anxiety. I have so many friends reaching out to me saying that they feel infinitely more relaxed after they incorporated some form of magnesium supplement into their routine. Now, one of the reasons I specifically like BioOptimizers is because their products are soy-free, gluten-free, lactose-free, non-GMO, free of chemicals and fillers, and they're made with all natural ingredients. So right now, if you're looking for a magnesium, BioOptimizers is offering my community 10% off. Just head over to magbreakthrough.com/Drew with the code Drew10. That's MAGBREAKTHROUGH.com/Drew, DHRU with the code Drew10, DHRU10, and get your BioOptimizers Magnesium Breakthrough today. So over the years, I've experimented with every different type of eating approach in the book. Raw foodist, vegan, vegetarian, meat eater, you name it, I've tried it. And the truth is, at first, I felt pretty darn good on all of them, until one day I didn't. The common denominator for all these diets is the fact that they're made up of mostly whole foods and free from processed foods, which will do anybody good. But after some time had passed, I still felt like I wasn't personally thriving. I was dealing with some lingering gut issues, endotoxemia, and acne breakouts, and nutritional deficiencies in some cases. Through a bunch of trial and error, I found that following one specific eating style wasn't the answer for me, and maybe it hasn't been the answer for you either. In my opinion, I think technology can be a critical part in the solution in helping us figure out what foods and dietary approaches best suited for our own unique makeup. That's why I was super excited when I heard about Insight Tracker. Insight Tracker helps take the guesswork out of living optimally and creates a nutrition, exercise, and lifestyle plan that's personalized for you based on your blood work, DNA, and personal preferences. Insight Tracker's cutting-edge technology gives you science-backed recommendations for positive changes to your daily habits. With their app, you can track your progress every day, and they have an amazing support team to help with all your questions. Insight Tracker looks at everything from metabolic and inflammatory markers to nutrients and hormones. It even tests things like your cortisol levels to help you better manage stress. And get this, you have the option to see how your inner age compares to your chronological age. Insight Tracker makes their results easy to understand and provides tips on how to use food first for optimal nutrition. Right now, they're offering my podcast community 20% off. Just go to insidetracker.com/Drew. That's D-H-R-U to get your discount code and try it for yourself today. That's insidetracker.com/DHRU for 20% off. The link is in the show notes. Definitely check it out. Today, we're talking about food. You got a new cookbook out. Let's talk about that. And on the topic of sugar, do you have any dessert, quote unquote, dessert style recipes? And what's your approach for sweet things in your own life? If you're not eating a lot of processed foods that have these things in them, not that you don't occasionally partake in some of this stuff, what's your approach to things when it comes to that dessert category?
I think it's really important to have planned to indulge. And I think to incorporate planned indulgences into your life. But the problem is today, I think we're indulging at every turn. Like we're eating cereal for breakfast, which is essentially a form of dessert, right? Most granola is a form of dessert. So we're doing that. We're eating granola bars or other energy bars throughout the day that are essentially, again, just desserts with fancy packaging on it. And then, of course, after dinner, we tend to want our dessert, and that's when we eat that. So I think we're overdoing it. That's clear. But there should be room in the diet for sweets and for indulgences and things like that. And so for me, there are a few, I don't want to say rules, but I guess guidelines that I like to abide by.
Let's break them down.
Yeah. So the best time to eat any kind of concentrated source of starch or even something with added sugar, whether it's a piece of cake or whatever, is going to be after some kind of activity, ideally a workout. Because after a workout, after you've engaged your muscles, you benefit from something called insulin-independent glucose uptake. So typically, when you consume a source of carbohydrates that breaks down into glucose, you see a rise in your blood glucose. And as a result, your pancreas then secretes insulin, whose job it is to get that sugar out of your blood, right? To bring you back to homeostasis. So it shuttles then that sugar into your musculature, into your liver cells. And so insulin is, it's a hormone. There's nothing bad about it, but a lot of us today have chronically elevated levels of insulin, which leads over time to chronically elevated levels of blood sugar. When you consume a sugar source in the post-workout setting, your muscles basically become a sponge for sugar. So when a cell meets the hormone insulin, receptors make their way up to the surface of the cell. These are called GLUT4 receptors, and this is what allows glucose to enter the cell. And the way it works is sort of like a lock and key scenario. Exercise causes those GLUT4 receptors channels to make their way up to the cell surface without the use of insulin. So you end up clearing that glucose from your blood and requiring less insulin to do the job, which all things considered is thought to be a beneficial consequence of exercise, because you're doing more with less in the body. So you're becoming more efficient due to exercise at partitioning that onslaught of energy. So that's why later in the day after a workout, I think it's ideal to ingest that indulgence, right? I've talked about what's called exercise snacking. So it doesn't have to be like a hour and a half long workout. You could just do some like air squats. Now that's if you're really crazy, right? You don't have to do that. I don't picture too many people listening to this doing air squats before their nightly dessert or whatever it happens to be. But that's where just going on a walk after dinner can be really useful. Studies have shown that going on a brief walk around the block reduces postprandial blood sugar, which all things considered, I think is a positive thing. You can also utilize different compounds to help towards the same goal, like acetic acid or vinegar is a great means of reducing the blood sugar spike after you consume starches, because they disrupt enzymes that break down the starches. Also, cinnamon has well-documented anti-hyperglycemic effects. So these are all, I think, really useful tools for people to have. But indulging every now and then, I think, is really important. It's really great. When I do, I use sweeteners that don't provide any added sugar and don't have any calories. So I personally am a big fan of monk fruit. I'm a big fan of stevia. Stevia can have an aftertaste. Actually, so can monk fruit. And that's why you'll tend to see both combined with a sugar alcohol sometimes, like erythritol. Erythritol is a sugar alcohol. People tend to be afraid of sugar alcohols because some of them can really upset your stomach and drive symptoms like gas, diarrhea, bloating, things that nobody wants. In fact, this is one of the reasons why prunes have such a well-known laxative effect, because they're loaded, they're a natural source of a certain sugar alcohol. I believe it's sorbitol. So you consume too much of that and you're going to the bathroom like nonstop. But erythritol is different because it's fully absorbed in the small intestine. So it doesn't draw water into the gut. It doesn't get fermented by gut bacteria and you end up peeing it out. So erythritol I find to be actually very well tolerated. Some people say that they don't tolerate it as well, which surprises me, because generally I find it to be very well tolerated and just, the pharmacokinetics of it, it gets fully absorbed. So it's I think very unlikely to drive GI upset. And then there's another newer sweetener on the market now that provides no calories called allulose, which I think is also pretty decent as well.
I know the doctors at our clinic, they're, especially if people have like a long history of like gut issues or were on antibiotics a lot as a kid or other stuff like that, they'll be cautious with a lot of the sugary alcohols because, again, if you have a sensitive stomach, you're going to have challenges anyway. I find xylitol is more of an issue for people than erythritol, but I'm one of those people that I don't do well with sugar,
erythritol?
With all sugar, pretty much all sugar alcohols.
Wow.
I just notice my stomach's a little bit rumbly. But again, this goes back to processed foods, which even health foods are a part of that. I think there was a no sugar coffee mixer, like you add it to coffee. I don't want to call it out by name. And the company's a great company. And I was drinking it every morning. And it has xylitol in there, right? It doesn't have erythritol in it. But also has monk fruit, stevia. Tastes amazing. Right? Tastes amazing. But I was noticing for me, after a period of time, there was a part of my hand that was getting like really dry. And like my skin started getting dry, like the way that I used to before I like cleaned up my diet. And so I was talking to my functional medicine practitioner and they were like, I see this a lot with people who have, you know, sensitive stomachs. If they're consuming a lot of sugar alcohols like xylitol, I was like, there's this thing that I drink every single morning and I've drinking it for the last year and a half. It has xylitol in it. He's like, look, just do a simple challenge. Just stop having that. See what happens. Give it at least like, 14 days, cut it out. Didn't add anything else, remove anything, just natural variation of my diet. And that dryness started to go away. So again, everybody's different. And in general, this goes back to your first point where, chances are you're not going to overdo even sugar alcohols if the base of your diet is a lot of these is just basically whole foods and not a lot of processed foods that you're including in the mix.
Yeah, absolutely. And you bring up an amazing point that everybody's different. There is no one size fits all diet. We all react to foods differently. And so I think that's a really important part of the equation. There was, there's actually this push now towards like plant-based sugar-free ice creams. Well, I guess there's a push towards a lot of different things, plant-based this and sugar-free that, but to add my own anecdote to the mix, I would typically, when I would want to have like an ice cream indulgence, right?
Yeah.
I would go and I would buy these sugar-free plant-based ice creams, usually coconut milk-based, sugar-free, usually have a lot of the sugar alcohols in it, which I typically do pretty well with, but there's also like a combination effect that could occur, right?
Totally.
Like maybe it's the MCTs in the coconut milk-based ice cream combining with the erythritol that's like leading to an upset stomach for some. So for me, I would buy these ice creams and I would find that I could have a little bit, but if I had too much, my stomach would just be a disaster, right? And so lately I've been experimenting with just like regular, and also like the ingredients lists on these ice creams are massive. Not that the number of ingredients in a product has any bearing on how good or bad for you a product is, but I think we can all agree that the more ingredients a product has, the more processed it tends to be, right?
Yeah.
So I made a switch. I was like, okay, what, how am I going to feel if I just eat like regular ice cream, like God forbid, dreaded regular ice cream, right? And so I went to the supermarket and I bought like some just regular ice cream with like whatever the four or five ingredients is that it takes to make regular ice cream,
yeah,
right? Like whole milk, cream, sugar, eggs. Yeah, yeah. Maybe a little bit of salt. And because I'm not lactose intolerant, I generally like to be deliberate with my dairy consumption. Mm-hmm. And dairy is something that actually my views on that are evolving.
Yeah, we'd love to talk about that.
But yeah, we'll talk about that. But just straight up regular ice cream, I ended up feeling a lot better afterwards than I would with these like more processed fake ice creams that purport to be healthier mm-hmm. than regular ice cream, right? But
totally.
But in actuality, I found that I felt. I was actually not prone to digestive discomfort after eating even a little bit too much, maybe, of regular ice cream. So
I think that's an important experiment and part of the larger aspect of when we reduce the number of total ingredients, not that that's an automatic reason to discount a product. When we reduce the total number of processing, total number of steps that go into something, even if we think of ourselves as somebody who eats fairly healthy, we could also see a lot of the same benefits that we're telling people who are traditionally eating extremely processed foods. And especially when it comes to some of these areas where, again, they're just creeping in our diet more so, you know, when it comes to like the processed, quote unquote, whole foods that we're getting exposed to. So let's talk about dairy for a second. You wrote about it in your new book, and I've done a couple podcasts with my business partner about his views of dairy have changed. I've started incorporating like goat kefir in my diet regularly. I still, when I eat a lot of dairy or I eat in certain types of dairy, I still don't feel the best. I break out other things for some reason. Goat kefir, I tend to do really well in. Give me your perspectives and what has caused you to like have a little bit of a shift in how you see dairy.
Yeah. So I still tend to be very deliberate about my dairy consumption. I think it's dairy is not something that I want at every meal. And I think that one of the issues with modern ultra processed foods and meals tend to be that there's just cheese added on everything, right? Like you can go into one of these big chain restaurants and order a salad, the healthiest dish that most people are going to eat over the course of the day, and it comes loaded with cheese on it, right? So typically I go dairy free, but I do think that dairy has unfairly been demonized especially in, I think, parts of the wellness world. And, you know, I guess we can start with protein. Dairy is a pristine source of protein. It consistently ranks as one of the highest biological value sources of protein that exists. Whether it's whey protein or casein, whey is an amazing, highly bioavailable source of protein, concentrated with essential amino acids, and in particular, leucine, which is really important for muscle protein synthesis and halting muscle protein breakdown, which is a really important way to maintain your lean mass as you age, which should be important to aging populations. So I routinely will do whey protein. Now, I'm not lactose intolerant, and I do acknowledge that 75% of the global adult population is lactose intolerant. So if dairy doesn't agree with you, don't consume it. Whey protein isolate, though, is almost 99.9% free of lactose and casein. So even among that, I've seen people that are otherwise dairy sensitive, they tend to do really well with whey protein. For me, whey protein is great. It's a very satiating snack. It feels indulgent because you can find them in all kinds of really delicious flavors now, vanilla, creamsicle, what have you. And newer brands are, you can get it from grass-fed cows, which you don't really need to spend the extra money to get whey protein from a grass-fed cow, because what a cow eats dictates primarily the healthiness of its fat. And whey protein is, you know, a protein shake is pretty fat-free. But you can get it, you can find protein shakes sweetened with stevia, and you can make a ton of different recipes with just whey protein. I mean, one of my favorite faux ice creams involves just whey protein and frozen berries. You just blend it all up and you get this really delicious kind of faux ice cream. And you get the benefits of whey protein, you get the benefits of berry consumption, which is, we know, great for brain health, among other things. So I think whey is great. When zooming out, I also think that Greek yogurt is a great product. I'm continually impressed that in a cup of Greek yogurt, and let's just say fat-free, right? that you get, you can get about 19 grams of protein in an 80 to 90 calorie serving. That to me is amazing. That's like a really fantastic and economical way to get very high biological value protein into your diet. Again, provided you're not sensitive to dairy. And then when you go to full fat dairy products like full fat Greek yogurt, cream, you're also getting a slew of really unique and probably important fat soluble antioxidants, which you lose, by the way, when you go fat free or reduced fat. So I reviewed this actually, this one paper that quantified the amount of vitamin K2 in various dairy products. And you lose it when you go for low fat or fat free. But in dairy products like cream, you get a significant amount of vitamin K2. You get about 88 micrograms of vitamin K2 in a single tablespoon serving. And vitamin K2 is sort of an underappreciated nutrient. Most people, when they think of vitamin K, they think of vitamin K1, which is involved in blood clotting. And very few people, if any people in Western society are deficient in vitamin K1, and you typically know because you're prone to bleeding. So it's a vitamin K deficiency. Vitamin K1 deficiency is pretty rare, but vitamin K2 people tend to underconsume, and it has different physiologic effects in the body. It helps maintain calcium homeostasis, so it helps deposit calcium into places you want calcium to be, like in your bones and your teeth, and it helps keep it out of soft tissue, which is where calcium actually shouldn't be allowed to congregate. So it keeps it out of arteries, kidneys, things like that. And vitamin K2 is relatively underconsumed because it is found, again, in full fat dairy. And there's been this push over the past couple of decades to steer consumers to reduced fat dairy. It tends to be higher in dairy products that come from grass fed cows. And most of our dairy comes from cows that are not fed grass, right? It's found in organ meats and things like that. So I think that full fat dairy is a great source of like pretty important, potentially important micronutrients like vitamin K too. And then finally, this has been an area of interest for me for some time, but full fat dairy contains a compound in it that is unique called milk fat globule membrane. And milk fat globule membrane is sort of like, you can think of it like a capsule that encapsulates the triglycerides, the fats that are typically found in dairy. Now, dairy is among all foods, dairy has the highest proportion of saturated fat. And yet, consumption of full-fat dairy is associated consistently with better cardiometabolic health. It's not associated with higher levels of LDL, higher incidence of cardiovascular disease. But saturated fat typically does raise your levels of LDL, which we know when that gets too high, that's a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. And so it seems to be that this milk fat globule membrane, it basically changes the way our bodies respond to the fat contained by dairy. And it's super interesting, actually. Heavy cream and butter are essentially the same. They start out from the same origin product, like butter is heavy cream that's simply been churned. But when you churn heavy cream to create butter, you're disrupting the milk fat globule membrane. And so that's why there have been feeding studies where they've shown that when you feed a person heavy cream, there's no impact on their lipids. They don't see an increase in their LDL, right? But when you feed a person butter, you do see an increase in their LDL. So that effect, that response is thought to be attributable to that protective effect seems to be attributable to the presence of milk fat globule membrane, which again is this encapsulation of the fats that dairy contains that's made up of proteins, different different phospholipids. And so that got me thinking, like, what is the purpose of dairy, right? The purpose of dairy, yeah, it's to grow a neonate, right? And in the case of bovine dairy, it's to grow a calf into a cow. But what part of the animal is the most rapidly growing part of the animal, especially early on? It's the brain, right? And so when you look at what milk fat globule membrane contains in it, it's rich in phosphatidylcholine, which we know is a really important component of brain cell membranes. It's rich in a compound called sphingomyelin, which is actually a core component of myelin, the myelin sheath that acts like insulation for your neurons. And so, you know, this, I tend to go down like rabbit holes, right? But there was, I looked to see if there was an association between dairy consumption and reduced risk for Alzheimer's disease. Now, an association isn't like a causal connection, it's a correlation, but there was a study that the first author was this guy, Oriol Willett, who his work I've been following for some time now because he publishes a lot on nutrients as it relates to brain health, which you know is my primary passion. And it was a study that involved food frequency questionnaires. So we know that these are not the most reliable because people tend to overrepresent on these questionnaires how healthy their diet was. They tend to underrepresent dietary components that are less healthy, healthy user bias, you know. But what they found was that above and beyond every single dietary component, the consumption of dairy was associated with a protective effect against cognitive decline. Mm. So all that being said, I've sort of become more of a fan of different types of dairy. I still eat it in moderation. Like I'll consume like 0 to 2 servings of dairy a day. And I'm not lactose intolerant, but I think it is interesting, these connections. And I also used to consume a lot more butter. Butter to me now, I put it in the category of, I consider it an indulgence because it's been chemically altered, and that chemical alteration creates the texture that we know and love and call butter, right? And I still use it occasionally, like here and there. I'm overall a fan of butter, but as a health food, I think it's probably better to put like, it's probably better to stick with, dairy components. Dairy products that still have intact milk fat globule membrane because of all the benefits that provides.
Yeah, it's super interesting as we just continue to learn more how people's own individual experimentation, you know, changes. Like I want to like whey so badly. It tastes good. There's so many great qualities that are out there like goat whey, sheep's whey, you know, all these different types of whey. And I've tried whey in different sorts of ways. And for me, again, my journey and health history started when I had really bad acne all throughout high school. And then I found out that it was primarily dairy. And again, being South Asian, Indian background, other stuff, there is a lot of dairy consumption there modernly, but do my genetics and background also make me more lactose intolerant? Not in the traditional way, but having challenges with lactose, who knows, gut microbiome alteration, whatever. So getting off of dairy, my skin cleared up in like 2 months.
Wow.
Like I went from being on like Accutane, different gel, all that different stuff. My skin was super bad. Cut out all dairy, and month and a half, 2 months, my skin looked as if it was minus scar tissue, looked completely clean. So then I thought, man, I have the answer. Like dairy is poison, right? And I would tell people, I was vegan at the time. I'd say, you know, this isn't a good situation. Wow. Naturally, then I found the world of functional medicine, started running all my labs and found out that actually, you know, I've been vegan now for like 7 years. Like a lot of this stuff isn't working, even though I felt great when I first started doing it. So I started including back in targeted foods. So I would have a little bit of cheese. So I thought, okay, a little bit of cheese, especially like European style cheese, I'm fine. I can enjoy it and I can have it with a little bit of, you know, like dinner or whatever here and there. But in general, I would include dairy. And then recently I saw a couple papers on just, on kefir and how like some people that had challenges. And I was really curious because I would get pimples again. I'd get a little bit of acne and things like that. And it was pretty much within 24 hours. Then I started having a little bit of goat kefir in the morning, like a serving, not every day, every so often. My digestion felt good that morning. Like in general, my digestion feels good, but I didn't have any sort of rumbling. I didn't have any challenges. I felt good. It was satiating. It doesn't have any sugar inside of it. So I'd put in a couple berries or some seeds or other stuff. And it's just amazing to see when you've written off a food, but you're open, you approach it in an open-minded way, as you did with, the inclusion of dairy back in your diet, you continue to follow the literature and you say, okay, let me try this and see if there's evidence that these studies are saying that this thing could be beneficial. let me see how I could personalize it for myself. For your case, it was, sounds like it was whey. I don't think you ever stopped having whey, right? You always had whey?
Yeah, I've always kind of integrated whey to some
but
degree.
But more like straight up, like dairy or heavy cream is what you've been trying.
Yeah. Yeah, that's sort of what I started to like reintegrate. I was for a little while doing the butter in my coffee thing.
Right.
Which I think is delicious. So just, I'll put that out there. I quite enjoy it. However, I carry a genotype that probably puts me at increased risk of hypercholesterolemia. So, you know, high cholesterol. And I'm not anti-cholesterol or anything like that.
Sure.
I'm an advocate of well-sourced animal consumption. But I do think it's important to like hedge your bets, you know, and to always do labs and to get tested and to be willing to iterate. To always, you know, I don't wear my personal diet, my dietary pattern as an identity, right? I think that's where people tend to go astray, especially today, when they make their diet their identity, because then they become unwilling to iterate when new data presents itself, or when they get labs and those labs don't necessarily agree with the picture of...
Sure, they planted a flag in the ground.
They planted the flag in the ground, exactly. So for me, I don't want to cause an undue elevation of my LDL levels when there's no really benefit in doing so. We know that certain saturated fats, and I talk about this in the book, do elevate LDL, right?
Sure.
The way that they do is they reduce the availability of the LDL receptor on the surface of the liver, which is really important for recycling those LDL particles, right? Certain genotypes are not as efficient at that. And I'm probably one of those people.
I'm definitely one of those people.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and this is interesting because I recently brought coffee back into my diet, and I want to bring up why coffee could be very particularly beneficial to people like
us.
Yeah,
let's talk about it.
But with something like grass-fed beef, so with every food, there are risks and there are benefits. It's my perspective, based on data, that the benefits of eating grass-fed beef outweigh any risks, because you're getting a highly nutrient-dense food with a pristine source of protein. You're getting compounds like creatine, which we know is reduced in the brain as we get older, vitamin E, a tiny amount of omega-3 fats, but you know, significant nonetheless. But mixing butter in my coffee, especially with regard to the milk fat globule membrane aspect that I mentioned earlier, it's probably going to cause your LDL to go up. And there's really no benefit that you're getting other than the fact that it's like delicious, right?
Also, MCT oil.
MCT oil.
Right.
Yeah.
Any kind of that sort of heavy dose saturated fat.
Yeah. MCT oil, I'm not sure does that.
I can tell you for me, it
does.
Did that.
Okay.
It did that.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's good to know. Yeah. I didn't necessarily want that to happen to me, but then I found these studies that found that heavy cream basically gives you the same, I mean, it's a dairy fat. You don't have to blend it. So that's like a great benefit of doing that. And because it has intact milk fat globule membrane, according to the data, it's not going to cause this elevation of LDL. So I'm essentially getting the same product, the same end product, which is like a creamy, indulgent, unctuous cup of coffee, right? But with a chemical difference that might be physiologically significant for me.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's always about that experimentation. Talking about labs, like how often do you personally, will you look at your labs, especially with this, history of high cholesterol or other stuff, or just looking at any sort of, you know, markers that are there, how often will you get your labs done?
Yeah. I mean, I try to do it once a year. And my family, I mean, people know my family history. My mother had very poor health. She had this rare form of dementia that developed when she was very young. And we know that vascular changes occur before almost every other change with regard to Alzheimer's disease, which is the most common form of dementia, and certainly vascular dementia. So cardiovascular health is crucially important, and it's something that I'm always mindful of. And again, every food has a benefit and a risk. Coffee, I think, is really interesting from this standpoint.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Yeah. So coffee is something that it's the world's most commonly consumed drug, right? It's a psychoactive drug. I love it. But I found at a certain point that coffee was starting to make me, starting to give me that tired and wired feeling. And so I took it out for a while and I felt great. This is another reason that I think many people feel shitty all the time, right? Because they are dependent on this drug that, that they need to consume in order to treat their withdrawal from it, that they're experiencing due to a 24-hour deficit of caffeine, right? And so for most people, when they consume coffee, they're not actually experiencing a performance boost above their baseline levels of performance. They're dependent on it, so they need to consume coffee to get back to their baseline level of performance. So for people who are not regular coffee drinkers, caffeine does provide a performance boosting effect. But for people who are chronic coffee drinkers, dependent on coffee, that caffeine is just, you need that morning cup because you're going to feel the unpleasant symptoms of withdrawal without it. And the other aspect of coffee that I think most people are not aware of is that coffee does give you an energy boost, but it doesn't create energy from thin air. It borrows it from later. And that's a debt that's going to be repaid later in the day. So that's what I was feeling personally when I was drinking coffee first thing in the morning. I would end up feeling like a train hit me by 2-3 in the afternoon, oftentimes leading me to the coffee pot to get some more coffee. And that was starting to just disrupt my sleep. And so I took coffee out to resensitize my brain to it. And then I brought it back in so that now I can consume it at the minimal effective dose for me. And I love it. I drink it now every day. But
what were you having before and how does that compare now? Was it just that you were having the quantity or just was that you didn't take a break enough for your body to reset?
I was having probably too much. So the dose was probably too high for me.
Which would be what?
Well, I know that I was in my coffee French press that I was using. I was putting probably like 4 or 5 tablespoons of grounds into that French press, which is probably like 300-400, if not more, milligrams of caffeine. And I was also drinking it first thing in the morning, which you don't typically want to do because caffeine can cause an elevation of cortisol levels. But first thing in the morning, your cortisol levels are already the highest that they're going to be all day because of the diurnal cortisol pattern. Cortisol is your body's waking hormone. It's what gets you out of bed. So once I took coffee out first to kind of press the reset button. And then I brought it back at a much lower dose. And I try to the best of my ability to drink it 45 minutes after I wake up to an hour after I wake up so that that cortisol spike starts to come down. The other thing that I did was...
The other great thing about that is it forces you to drink water first thing in the morning.
Oh, yeah.
Which is also, I think, on one of your posts here or there, you know, people go to caffeine first.
Right.
And then it's like, well, coffee's made out of water, so it's all good.
Yeah. But
that's the first liquid that they have in the day. So they're already dehydrated waking up. Their cortisol is already high. And they're drinking something that's making them more dehydrated first thing in the morning. So sorry to interrupt, but that's another thing that you get for delaying coffee a little bit is you get to sneak in that water and make sure that that's the first thing that you have in the morning.
That's a great point. People when trying to set healthy new habits, you want a habit stack. And so giving yourself that extra time in the morning and throwing in some new habits in it, because you know you've got your coffee habit coming up. But that's a great opportunity to drink some water, hydrate, maybe put some electrolytes into the mix. So I brought it back. And also, I learned a few things about how to make coffee healthier. So for one, I was French pressing my coffee, as I mentioned. When you, coffee has a compound in it called cafestol, which is sort of a double-edged sword. It's a compound that has been shown to improve insulin sensitivity, but powerfully also raise levels of LDL cholesterol. And when you use a paper filter, the paper filter absorbs all of that compound, all of that cafestol, whereas a French press doesn't absorb any of it. So if you French press your coffee and you're prone to hypercholesterolemia, maybe you have high cholesterol, you want to get rid of the French press and use a pour over or a coffee machine or whatever, just something that utilizes a paper filter, which absorbs almost all of that cafestol compound, which again is one of the most powerful, It's one of the most powerfully known elevators of LDL cholesterol in humans. Mm. Yeah. And it does this, I forget how it does it actually. I think it might have something to do with reducing, again, availability of the LDL receptor, this one compound. But you absorb nearly all of it with just a paper filter. So I got rid of my French press and now I'm using a pour over where I have an unbleached paper filter that I use. And I know that that is actually helpful. That is going to have a meaningful impact, right?
Wow.
Yeah.
I make an espresso in the morning. I wonder if I can make that espresso. My friend gifted me a little wedding present and it's like, I'm on one of those nice Italian machines,
yeah,
condensed. I wonder if I could pour that through a paper filter afterwards.
Maybe. Yeah, it would. It would potentially help.
And you think it makes that much of a difference?
I do. Yeah. With a French press, you're getting about, I believe it's like 6 milligrams of this cafe stall compound. People can look it up. You can easily Google cafe stall. I'm not making it up. It's a compound in coffee that's fully absorbed by the paper filter. I think after using a paper filter, you get about 0.2 milligrams or something. It's like a dramatic reduction of cafe stall yield in the cup. And yeah, that's enough to have a significant effect. But the other thing that coffee was recently, and caffeine specifically, has been found to do, which is actually a really positive thing, is it was found that caffeine is a natural PCSK9 inhibitor. Mm-hmm. There's a new class of cholesterol-lowering drugs on the market that are called PCSK9 inhibitors. So most people are familiar with statins. Statins reduce the ability of your liver to synthesize cholesterol. But PCSK9 inhibitors, the way they work is they increase, by inhibiting this protein, PCSK9, they cause an increase in the availability of this LDL receptor, which is really great for helping to pick up these remnant LDL particles that have been sent out in circulation after they do their job of dropping off cholesterol and triglycerides all around the body. The liver, its job is to pick those remnant lipoprotein particles up, right, before they have the chance to get small and dense. Because I'm sure you've talked about the difference between large and fluffy LDL particles and small and dense particles. The longer an LDL particle spends in circulation, the smaller and denser it's going to get.
Yep.
So we want to do everything we can to optimize the efficiency of our livers for recycling LDL. And this is true. This is true for everybody, but it's certainly true for people with specific genotypes, mine included. So caffeine was shown in this study that just came out to inhibit PCSK9 by about 25%. I believe the dose was something like, I believe it was 400 milligrams of caffeine, which is quite a bit of caffeine. So I'm not recommending such high a dose, but it is cool to know that via this mechanism, coffee can actually increase the efficiency of your liver to recycle these LDL lipoproteins, which is great, right?
It's great.
Yeah. Cause coffee consumption observationally has been consistently associated with reduced risk for cardiovascular disease, for certain neurodegenerative conditions, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, MS, all these things. But it's like, is there a mechanism that could explain that, right?
Sure.
And this is a pretty significant mechanism, pretty plausible.
How much do you think? I mean, we know all the research that's out there on LDL, and we've done episodes on and other stuff, but how much do you think is, when people talk about elevated levels of LDL, and then of course, you know, people can always get like an NMR test and look at the actual particle size buildup, you know, do they have the right amount of, you know, do they have a lot of small dense ones, which you talked about and why they're problematic? Do you have big and fluffy ones and it's not as much of an issue and everything when it comes to the cholesterol and lipids conversation? How much of the conversation around LDLs do you think is the association of LDLs with people who have just tend to have very inflammatory diets, a lot of processed sugar, other stuff? And, you know, what would be a great study that you'd like to see when it came to people like me and you who typically don't eat a lot of processed foods and might have a tendency to lean towards higher LDL? What would be a study that you'd like to see that would give you more information about just how worried should we be about it? But again, we want to try to hedge our bets, but yeah, what would be a study? I'd be curious if you have a take on that.
Yeah. I think that With regard to the foods that we know that can potentially raise LDL, we have to ask ourselves, do the benefits outweigh the risks? And for foods like grass-fed beef, any animal product, I mean, you know, even wild salmon, fatty fish in general, which is associated with better cardiovascular health, has saturated fat in it. So we can't demonize a single nutrient in isolation. That makes no sense to do that. And also, even when we say saturated fat, there are different kinds of saturated fatty acids. There is myristic acid, there's palmitic acid, there's stearic acid, right? They all have different effects on the body. So if you're just saying saturated fat is bad, you, to somebody who actually knows what they're talking about, you don't sound like you know what you're talking about, because stearic acid, for example, has a neutral effect on lipids like LDL, and in fact could actually potentially play a positive role for health. It's been shown to boost mitochondrial function, for example, right? When you take a cow and you feed a cow grass for the entirety of its life, you're going to see a higher proportion of stearic acid, which again is, from a cardiovascular standpoint, totally neutral, if not healthy. You're going to see less overall saturated fat. You're going to see more omega-3s. And so the benefits, I think, of eating that food outweighs any risk. The benefits of eating fish today still seem to outweigh any risks. Breast milk, right, is loaded with saturated fat. It's one of the perfect foods that nature has devised to grow a developing brain, right? So I don't think, I think when we take a food-centric approach, I mean, that really to me is, that ultimately answers the question of how much value do I place on LDL. I think if you're eating an overall healthy dietary pattern that is primarily constituted with minimally processed foods, and you're not overdoing it with butter, which is a, dairy is nature's creation, right? But butter is a man-made creation. So certain genotypes, I think, don't do as well with butter. Also ghee. Ghee is a derivative of butter. Ghee has, and I think ghee is great in certain recipes. I certainly use it. It's very stable at high temperatures. But ghee is basically butter, but then you have the added effect of having a high prevalence of oxidized cholesterol in it, which I don't think is necessarily great to overconsume. So I tend to take a food-centric approach and optimize like the diet. And then if everything else was good on my labs, and then I saw my LDL was in the, you know, maybe the high normal range, I personally wouldn't medicate myself based on that. I wouldn't be too concerned. I'll caveat that by saying I'm not a medical doctor, but I personally would not be, you know, if my overall metabolic health was good, if I didn't have an oversized waistline, if my A1C was nice and low, if my blood pressure was nice and healthy, my fasting insulin, my fasting blood sugar were low, my HDL was high, my triglycerides were low, and my LDL was maybe 130 or something like that, which is probably above what the guidelines would call pristine, I would probably be fine with that. Because there are consequences to cutting out foods that I would have to cut out to get that pristine LDL, right? I would have to cut out the grass-fed beef. I would have to maybe eat a lower overall fat diet, right? Which we know can reduce levels of testosterone, which provides many benefits, well-being, libido, body composition. So treating based on just an isolated number, I don't think makes any sense.
Yeah. And just more of what we can expect when we look at the patient as a whole and just follow all the rules inside of precision medicine. What you described is basically me. My LDL was much higher than that, you know? And, but all my other things, I even went in just because family history, other stuff, being South Asian, there's a lot of cardiovascular disease in that category, mostly because of sedentary lifestyle, a lot of fried food, a lot of sugar, other things, those are not in there. But I even got on top of what the tests you mentioned, I went and got a calcium score test just to make sure like all was good because my LDL was really high, but still hedging our bets. And because of some other stuff, I had an expert on the podcast who, microbiologist who was talking about in some people who have had challenging gut health histories, which I was on a lot of antibiotics as a kid, my gut got messed up. High amounts of concentrated saturated fat, concentrated, like in one go, like butter, MCT, that sort of thing.
Yeah, coconut not like oil, butter, yeah.
Coconut oil, in my case, I was consuming a lot of coconut oil. I was with coconut, a lot of oil.
Right.
That can also have an endotoxemia reaction inside the body, where you get all this, you can get leakage into the bloodstream and bacteria and other stuff and things like that. And so just hedging took out a lot of that sort of added fat that you talk about in my diet out, went back to just whole foods. And in my particular case, I did remove grass-fed beef because I noticed that I was still having some challenges with it. And I love grass-fed beef. It tastes great. And it was one of those things that I was weighing out. Like, should I do it?
Well, you could do leaner. I mean, a beef tenderloin is like, most people don't know, but tenderloin, like there are, I did an Instagram post on just breaking down the different beef cuts. There are leaner cuts out there.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that you need to eat beef.
Sure.
I know that I talk a lot about it because I think it's a very nutrient dense food. You don't need it, but there are like lean options.
I got to try that. I got to definitely try that.
Yeah.
And anyways, you know, things started heading in the right direction. I'm due for a test next week, so I'll give you an update and let you know.
Yeah.
But my calcium score test came back, you know, is zero, which means that there's no calcium plaque buildup that's there. My CRP, everything else was in a great range. So again, it's all about looking at the totality of everything that's there. Mm-hmm. But being willing to question certain stuff, if you see that your labs are heading not in the right direction. Let's pivot for a second. You know, we talked a lot about fat. We talked about dairy, talked about oils. What is another category of food that you took on in your new cookbook? Link is in the show notes for everybody who's listening. What's a category of foods that you wrote about where maybe you have a little bit of a different take than some of the common thought process or trends that are out there when it comes to that category?
Oh man, there's so many. I mean, I talk about salt quite a bit.
Let's talk about salt.
Yeah, I think salt's really important. The vast majority of salt, sodium that your average American consumes comes from restaurant food, fast food, and ultra processed foods, and also canned foods. And I think that the reason for that is, well, there are a few reasons, but when you make a shelf stable food, you're losing some of the taste condoning qualities of volatile organic compounds that are best when fresh. One of the reasons why fresh food tends to be so much tastier than preserved food, canned food. And so to compensate, manufacturers will often add sodium to these products. And I mean, I think that's a big problem. We tend not to underconsume sodium. Most Americans are consuming lots and lots of sodium, but only because they're consuming lots and lots of these ultra-processed products. But when you take those products out, it's important to realize that only 11% of the sodium that people consume every day come from their own salt shakers, come from the salt that they add to recipes that they're making, for example. And so for people who are working to optimize their diets, which I know is a significant portion of the people who listen to this show, it becomes then a question of like, where are you getting your salt from? Because sodium is a macro mineral. We need it for good health. Especially, you know, as you get older, older adults suffer from hyponatremia. They're not getting enough sodium. And sodium is really important for nerve signal transduction, really important for maintaining healthy blood volume. If you sweat regularly, which I do because I love using saunas, I exercise fairly regularly, you need to actually increase the amount of sodium that you're consuming. Also, if you are on a low carbohydrate diet, you tend to require more sodium. A lot of people that are transitioning to a low carb diet for the first time will experience what's called the low carb flu, which can be mitigated by including more sodium into one's diet. So I think that salt is a really important, well, sodium is an important nutrient. And then from a culinary standpoint, I think salt is just, it's the easiest way to take an ingredient and turn it into food. You know what I'm saying? Like if you have a ribeye, for example, it's not a steak until you add salt to it. It's when you have vegetables, some of the incredibly healthful, life-supportive vegetables in the produce section of the supermarket. If you're not adding salt and seasoning those vegetables well, you're not going to be able to convince your kids to eat them. You're not going to enjoy eating them. I actually think, this is my own hypothesis, but this is one of the reasons why so many people are now adopting these carnivore diets, because these are people who, as children, just didn't have well-seasoned vegetables. And I was lucky. I grew up, my mother was really good. I mean, she loved, you know, seasoning vegetables. She would throw salt, garlic, pepper. We didn't use a lot of butter in my house growing up because my mom, she was big on the vegetable oil and the margarines and stuff like that, because she was actually afraid of heart disease. So I grew up eating those kinds of fake fats. But yeah, I mean, I think salt is an incredibly important culinary staple to elevate the quality of your food. In the book, I talk about the different kinds of salt. You have fine salt, coarse salt, and flake salt. Flake salt to me is something that, if you don't have it in your kitchen, it's one of the easiest ways to elevate the quality of your food to restaurant quality. It's super inexpensive, but just finishing your dishes with a little bit of flake salt to me is like one of the best finishing moves to impress guests, friends, family. It's really, really, really important. So yeah, sodium was one of those things that I think people misunderstand. There's been a number of studies that have come out showing that sodium's impact. So with regard to the health aspect of sodium, there is a small portion of the population that is sodium sensitive. Those people tend to be in the minority. I bet I think it's about 25%. Obviously, people with hypertension, the proportion is going to be a bit higher, but most people are not responsive to sodium from the standpoint of their blood pressure. And I think that's really, really important, that for most people, sodium doesn't really have an impact in terms of your blood pressure. Other things do. So we were talking about added sugar.
Right.
Added sugar plays a huge role in, I think, the hypertension epidemic. There was one study that found that one single sugar sweetened beverage raised subjects' systolic blood pressure for 2 hours after ingestion. And it was actually the same amount of sugar in that beverage as people are consuming all day, every day on average.
Even fructose, like just straight up fruit juice, just straight up orange juice. If somebody's starting every morning off with orange juice, we had Dr. Richard Johnson on the podcast, and he's got a new book out, and he was the researcher that really understood the link between, you know, uric acid and why it got so important and led to David Perlmutter's book and other people's books that are out there. He's done a lot of studies and in the space of hypertension. And originally, of course, you know, talking about concentrated salt being an issue for people. And again, putting in the caveat that most of it's going to come from the food that we get outside, the processed food, the restaurants, the other stuff, people that add salt to it. But he actually found and ended up going, because, you know, he's a nephrologist, kidney doctor. He ended up going from just salt to now looking at when you have concentrated forms of fructose, how that impacts hypertension in patients, and was able to, with concentrated sorts of fructose in mice, and later seeing in observational studies with, you know, human beings, that you can induce high blood pressure just by giving people like strong amounts of fructose in their diet.
Wow. Yeah, it's not surprising. When you feed somebody a huge bolus of sugar, it stimulates their sympathetic nervous system, which is like their fight or flight response, which is like, you know, your blood pressure increases. So I think that's a bigger problem. And obviously refined grains play a role there as well, because refined grains break down almost instantly to sugar, whether or not it appears like sugar, it biologically is no different. And so with regard to sodium, I think it's the hype is the danger signal is definitely, overblown. Now, the consumption of potassium also plays a role in helping balance out the effect that sodium has on your blood pressure. So making sure that you're eating a healthy diet. I think researchers believe that we used to consume about 4 times as much potassium as hunter-gatherers as we do now. And potassium could be found in fruits and vegetables are loaded with potassium, but also most people aren't aware, but wild salmon and beef are actually very good sources of potassium. Much higher in terms of their potassium content than their natural sodium content. So making sure that you're getting potassium on a daily basis, I think is really helpful. And again, cutting out the ultra processed foods, because this advice to stop adding salt to your food is just completely misguided. It's really bad advice, because people are just, they're making their food more bland. Some of the most healthy foods in the supermarket are simply not palatable without the addition of salt. And the number one source of dietary sodium in the American diet, you would think that it would be like processed meat or canned foods. It's not. It's bread and rolls. But when was the last time you heard a dietitian tell you to avoid bread and rolls, right? To get your blood pressure in check? You'll never hear that, right? They say limit your salt intake. And so what do most people do? They stop using, they shun the salt shaker.
Mm.
It's so misguided. It's so backwards.
So backwards. You know, on the topic of like ultra processed foods, there's also the component of just eating just throughout the day, literally morning to evening, eating just all the time, you know, grazing all the time, eating all the time, just continuously eating. Where does fasting play in for you, and what do you follow, and do you ever go about longer periods of a fast to give your system a break?
Yeah, really good question. I generally do a sort of mild intermittent fasting, I guess, protocol where I try not to eat for the first 2 hours of my morning, with the exception of, I guess, coffee in there, electrolytes, maybe some heavy cream now in my coffee. And heavy cream is fine. Coffee and cream both technically break a fast, but the cream has no protein, no sugar in it. So it's some of the mechanisms that we're attempting to, some of the strings that we're attempting to pull with fasting, like prolonged mTOR inhibition or spending more time in a low insulin state. Heavy cream, coffee are not going to perturb that. So I don't really consider either of those as breaking my fast, so to speak. But when it comes to food, I generally will have my first meal of the day at about 10:30 to 11:30 every day, depending on sort of what my circumstances allow. I generally like to go into meetings and if I have to give a presentation, I like to do that in a fasted state just because I feel more alert. I also like to exercise while fasted. That's just my personal preference. So I'll typically work out in the morning, and then right after that, I'll break my fast with my first meal of the day. And generally I'm prioritizing protein. This concept of an anabolic window, has been sort of debunked over the past couple of years, but if you're in a fasted state and you exercise, you do really want to make sure that you're getting protein, like a good, 30 to 40 grams of protein soon after your workout. And so that's generally what I'll do. So I'll go and I'll you know, optimize for protein, have some grilled veggies, maybe a salad, which is what I had today. And then at the latter end of the day, I try to curtail my food consumption to 2 to 3 hours before bed, sometimes longer, but it's just impractical for me because I enjoy having dinner with my brothers, friends, whenever I have the opportunity. So I think being social is really important. And if we're being dogmatic about fasting and we're foregoing social opportunities, I don't think that we're doing it. I don't think that's it, you know? But I do try to curtail my food consumption to 2 to 3 hours before bed. The research that I've seen that seems to be coming out, and granted, these are small studies and they primarily utilize men, so they're not done typically in women, unfortunately, especially premenopausal women. They tend to use postmenopausal women so they can control for, you know, the monthly rhythm and stuff like that. So, but you know, with the research that has been done, clinical trials that have been done, we can see that even when controlling for calories, so even when not trying to push these subjects into a calorie deficit so that they lose weight, we still see that there's an improvement in various cardiometabolic features like blood glucose regulation, blood pressure, and the like. So from that standpoint, I think it's good to eat an earlier dinner from the standpoint of metabolic health. From the standpoint of weight loss, I mean, I think some people wield intermittent fasting as like this miracle weight loss formula. I don't think it's that. I think it can provide a means of controlling calories, which for some people, it's going to be very effective and very helpful. So by curtailing your food consumption to 8 to 10 to 12 hours a day, which, by the way, most Americans are consuming the full 16 hours that they're awake. From the moment they wake up until the moment they go to bed, they're eating, metabolizing some kind of food, right? But what circadian biology is showing us is that aside from the calorie control aspect of it, we seem to see an improvement in various cardiometabolic features when we curtail our food consumption. Also, from the standpoint of brain health, I think it's useful. The grandfather of intermittent fasting may as well be Mark Mattson, who is a researcher at the NIH who, for at least a decade at this point, has been showing us the potential brain benefits that come from fasting, such as an increase in BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is sort of like a miracle grow protein for the brain. I don't know if that has necessarily been elucidated in humans yet, but every prevention-minded neurologist that I've spoken to with their patients tends to integrate some kind of intermittent fasting protocol. That's typically what I do. And I think circadian biology is, you know, there's not a single organ system that's not affected by circadian rhythms in one sense or another. And our eyes are the master time setter for our body because they interact with what's called the suprachiasmatic nucleus in our hypothalamus, which is, again, it's sort of like the Big Ben of our genome. But food plays a role too in activating what are called peripheral clocks. And so we're diurnal creatures. We're meant to eat during the day. So that's why I think it's important to curtail your food consumption until to a few hours before you go to sleep. Also, for people suffering with digestive discomfort, this is something that I discovered and wrote about in Genius Kitchen, which I wasn't familiar with before writing the book, but the migrating motor complex, which is this system that gets going after 90 minutes of not eating, that basically serves as a housekeeping wave that flushes debris, bacteria, dead epithelial cells from your stomach all the way down to the end of your small intestine. It's a great way to help prevent or even possibly treat SIBO by just not eating, by not snacking too much. And so after I discovered that sort of phenomena, it was reason enough for me to think twice before snacking in between meals. So now generally I'll eat when I break my fast in the morning, I'll eat before I go to bed. Maybe I'll have, you know, a piece of fresh fruit and a protein shake or a cup of Greek yogurt sort of midday. But I now try, and I don't always succeed. I don't think that you have to do this every day, but I try to go about 4 hours in between meals and snacks.
That's great. It's always nice when somebody walks you through just their approach. Again, that doesn't mean that's going to be yours, but it becomes a little bit more realistic and you're like, okay, great. I could do this, you know, I could try this and I could see if it works for me. While we start to wind down towards the time that we have over here, I want to go back to that post that I had referenced. You know, we're interweaving, why do I feel shitty all the time on top of the pack of the new book and kind of highlighting out different things in both sides that contribute to people not feeling great and what we do to optimize. So I want to shift off of food topics for a second. And I'm going to read you back out the list and give me a couple of those that you might just want to go through a quick rant on. Okay. How's that sound?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so we talked about ultra-processed foods. That was number one. Zero exercise, sitting all day, poor posture, too much alcohol. We talked about the caffeine one, too much caffeine. Sun plus nature deprived, crappy sleep, and overuse, I'm guessing, of social media. You just have social media, but I'm guessing you mean overuse of social media. Give me one of those that you might want to toss out a little rant on.
Oh man. Well, I think sitting all day is a big problem. When you're sedentary for an extended period of time, blood literally drains from your brain. I mean, just think about it that way. Like you're sitting, your brain is at the top of your body, right? Blood literally drains. And by just integrating a little bit of movement, you help reperfuse the brain for all intents and purposes. And all it takes is just a few minutes of walking around. If you're stuck at a desk for every half an hour of seated time, go up and walk around for 2 minutes. That's literally all it takes. I tend to find myself prone to headaches when I'm sitting for an extended period of time. But we know that the brain thrives when the body is moving, and that it suffers when we are when we're sitting all day. I mean, it's like blood. Our bodies literally serve, in effect, as a pump to get blood up to the brain. Right. I mean, yeah, we have our heart, but the brain is affected by what goes on down below. There was a really interesting study that came out a few years ago. It was fascinating that found that just being underwater with your head out, that the pressure that being underwater puts on your body increased cerebral perfusion by about 14% or something like that. So movement is so key, right? And I think that's one of the major reasons why people tend to feel crappy today, is that they're just overly sedentary. I mean, we know that when you exercise, and by the way, there are different kinds of movement. There's exercise, which underneath the umbrella of exercise, you've got your anaerobic and your aerobic exercise, which we could break apart. But then non-exercise physical activity, I think, is probably the most important, because it's just the daily movements that we do all day that we don't necessarily count as exercise, but that plays such a huge role in terms of fostering metabolic health, keeping fresh blood, oxygen, nutrients flowing up to the brain. And that can be anything from dancing to taking the stairs to going on a walk to, I mean, technically even tapping your foot is non-exercise. Fidgeting, for example, is non-exercise physical activity. Doing chores around the house, laundry, chasing your cat, which I do, you know, sometimes. All of these play an important role. And then exercise, we know, anaerobic exercise, whether it's weight training or high intensity interval training, really important for gaining, for correcting metabolic illness, for becoming more resilient, for improving cardiorespiratory fitness, which is all so related to living a longer life with greater health span. Aerobic exercise for, again, cardiorespiratory fitness plays an important role in reducing risk of early mortality. So yeah, being as active as you can, right? And for me, my level of high intensity, quote unquote, exercise can be different from yours, right? Because I've been working out, for example, my whole life. I don't necessarily look like it, but I've been working out for 25 years at this point. So what's high intensity for me is going to be different than what it is for you. So we can't compare, you know, from individual to individual and make those sorts of comparisons. But as long as you're giving it your best and doing the best that you can for you, given your fitness levels, given your age, given your ability, the whatever constructs and constraints that you have in your life, you have to do that. Because that's, I think, I mean, when it comes to the brain, exercise is medicine.
Mm. Well said. All right, a couple of random thoughts that I want to get your thoughts on.
Let's do it.
Okay. The world of nutrition can be kind of confusing for a lot of people. And you do a good job on your Instagram. If you're not following Max on Instagram, please check him out. Even if you're completely opposed to social media, just sign up and, you know, check out his post, because I think you do a really good job of just breaking things down. And you tackle a lot of topics where one group or another might have very strong opinions on it.
Yeah.
Like people telling individuals to be fruit phobic and talking about why we should not fear, you know, having a whole piece of fruit and regularly having fruit in our, you know, diet, or people attacking things like eggs or, you know, whatever. You do a really good job about it.
Thank you. Means a lot coming from you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. So one of the things is, it's very easy to get attention for a very strongly held opinion, whatever that might be. So I had an idea, which was, I want to start a nonprofit, fund it a little bit. And if anybody writes about nutrition or is advocating one particular diet, and actually you don't advocate a particular diet, but it really feels like this is the right way to approach things. Every quarter, they have to have, you know, through a third party, their labs uploaded into the system, vetted, you know, it's by a third party. And again, You know, just like if you're going to have strong opinions on how other people should be, you should be part of the open source database of being able to look at everybody's labs and track them over a period of time. What are the good things about that? What are the bad things about that?
Oh, man. Well, nobody's going to do it for one. But I kind of respect. Well, actually, I don't know about that, because some of the carnivore guys have been pretty transparent about their labs.
Right? There are people that are out there that have done it. Yeah. I just don't think everybody's done it.
Right. Not everybody's done it. I think that we would then start to argue about like what's better, what's optimal versus what's not, right? I mean, you'll have vegans showing their labs and maybe their LDL levels are on the floor, and then you've got carnivores and their LDL levels are maybe, you know, higher. I'm sure that both will be in pristine metabolic health otherwise, but then they'll then
and maybe.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of people, it's just human nature. I think there's a lot of people that talk about getting rich who may not actually have a lot of wealth themselves. There's a lot of people who talk about kindness who may not be the kindness to their own family members that are there. I think it's human nature to talk about something and maybe not always do something. So just wanted to toss that in.
Yeah. I mean, I would share my labs with people.
So your game, you're in.
I'd be in. Yeah. There's this call for nutrition researchers to disclose in nutrition papers what diets they adhere to in terms of the research.
Right.
Because we know, as I mentioned earlier, people tend to make their diets their identities. If you're reading a nutrition paper and it seems to point to poor health outcomes due to animal product consumption, right? And the authors of the paper are all vegan. And maybe some of them have authored vegan diet books. Wouldn't you think that would be important to know when you know sure. when a clinician is reading that paper? Absolutely, but they don't do that. I mean, they'll disclose diet books usually and things like that, but they don't disclose their diet proclivities personally. So I think that's important. So yeah, going back to your question, I think it could potentially be useful. Although, I mean, I just don't know. I think that there are still too many unanswered questions, like that people who are like you, inquisitive and like me, that know, that are aware of that, right, that might be able to interpret that data with a more open mind. Some, for example, in the plant-based community might see somebody like Sean Baker's LDL levels and be like, oh, he's, you know, on the fast track to having a heart attack. And that might support their confirmation bias. So I still worry about the problems with interpreting that data were it to get out there and see a wider audience.
Fair enough. All right. Yeah. Well, I'll keep you posted if I end up doing it.
Are you serious? That's a cool idea. That's a good question. I'm serious.
Because I also know too, I've changed my mind over the years.
Yeah.
I've changed how I eat. I was grown up vegetarian. I went vegan. My acne cleared up like a miracle. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is the fucking answer.
Yeah.
And I just kept on that path until I started feeling like my brain wasn't working as good as it was. And I just felt, my digestion, which was great for a long time, started acting up again towards the end when I was eating a lot of, you know, quinoa and brown rice and these other types of foods in my diet. And then found out the world of functional medicine, connected with some great doctors, ran my Omega Quant test, you know, it's still like one of my top tests for anybody, you know, you could do at home and look at your omega-3 to omega-6 ratio. Mine was completely off.
Wow.
And I was like, I think I got to start eating fish. Mm. And I felt better within weeks. And like, I felt like my brain just turned on again. And I also cut out a lot of grains at the same time. So that played a role too. So I just know that I've changed my mind over a period of time. And I think that this goes in my second question, you know, in this world that we live in, well, it's a statement rather, and I want your hot take on it. In this world that we live in, polarization often gets a bad rap, right? Like things are so polarized in social media and other things like that. And I'm not going to say that polarization is, there are parts of it, especially when it comes with unkindness, accusations, you know, whatever it might be. But largely, I think polarization, a lot of different opinions and people doing a lot of different things, I think it's actually a good thing. And I think the good thing that comes from that is that people are all trying to share and put out their idea of what they feel is the best way possible. And I think it's access to more information that kind of sifts through it. And by the way, there's no going backwards. Like, what is the answer to polarization? Everybody has the same opinion and looks at things the same exact way. So you have a hot take on that from the world of nutrition or even broader than that?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I know that my first, my on-ramp to the health and wellness world was before my mom. It was like books, right? Like written for the lay audience. Like, dude, like diet books are not meant for an academic audience. And so that was my on-ramp. And then you kind of learn the more you marinate in the wellness world, you realize that people are just kind of, you know, we have nutrition data, but nutrition science is really hard to do. And it's left a lot of unanswered questions. And so it's left room, I think, for the better, for people to come and put their sort of spin on things, right? To lend a bit of philosophy to the conversation, right? Like I have the data when it comes to nutrition, right? But I also am guided by my philosophy of what it means to eat properly today, and the kinds of companies that I want to support with my dollar, right? So I know that, you know, for example, Dr. Hyman has a philosophy that permeates his work. Dr. Gundry has a philosophy that permeates his work. A lot of physicians do that have written books. And I think that the plurality of voices, I'm grateful for it. I think that it's a net positive. It's just more tools, more information, more points of entry and access for your average person to engage with these topics. And then hopefully, I know that Dr. Hyman does it so well, but hopefully prominent voices are responsible enough to then implore their audiences to do their own kind of inquiry and to iterate and to tinker. I know that one of my favorite passages of Genius Foods, which was my first book, is actually the closing thoughts, a little couple of paragraphs that I wrote at the end of the book, final thoughts, where I talk about the fact that, like, this is everything that I believe to be true, but ultimately science is evolving, right? It's not this end all be all indicator of truth, right? It's a process of asking questions and finding answers. And what we accept to be true today might be disproven 5 years from now. So I think that people really need to, I think it's great that we have all these different voices out there and that some are polarizing, some are not. As long as we can communicate respectfully with one another and with an open mind and be kind to one another, I think that public health as a whole is going to benefit. There are some people in the space, unfortunately, that are, I see as being the bad apples, who are polarizing, but then they're also vitriolic and they're abrasive. And I don't appreciate those personalities.
Kindness and respect. That has to be the foundation.
The foundation. Yeah. That's something that you exude. You exude both of those qualities. And that's why I think you're so great at what you do, among many other reasons. I'm so glad that your brain is now working at 100% capacity because we need your brain, Drew.
And we need all the brains of the people that are listening as well.
Yeah.
Brother, two recipes from the new book that you think are going to be, you know, hits for the audience. Just talk about them. And then let's chat about, you know, how people can find the book but give us two recipes that you think that really stand out.
Two recipes. Well, okay. So one of my favorite recipes in the book is a plant-based, because I do actually have some plant-based recipes in the book. It's a plant-based mac and cheese using carrot noodles.
Mm.
It's really good. So it's a carrot noodle. We use like a spiralizer-based vegan mac and cheese. So there's no dairy in it. And it's just really damn tasty, like really savory and delicious.
Wow. And what's like the base of the cheese? Is it like nuts?
It's a nutritional yeast based cheese. And then we've got some, I mean, I utilize nuts in the book. It's really good. It actually reminds me of another one of my favorite recipes is a Brazil nut pesto with kelp noodles. So I'm a huge fan of pesto, which is usually made with pine nuts. And And pesto is usually also placed on like pasta, like wheat-based pasta. But this is actually a recipe that I created. It's out of this world delicious, but it also purposefully supports thyroid health. Kelp noodles are an amazing source of iodine, and Brazil nuts are one of the top sources of selenium. Mm. So it's like the best pesto you've ever had, which you can use on anything. But this recipe, we combine it with kelp noodles, and it's just really good. I mean, it charges you up. It just like charges your body up, especially for people that don't regularly consume selenium and iodine, which are important nutrients for thyroid hormone production. So there's that. There's a few different like quote unquote pasta dishes in the book. The whole book is gluten-free, grain-free, minimal dairy in the book. Although I do utilize in a handful of recipes, some ghee, butter, just for the flavor profile. There's another recipe in the book. Sorry, I'm like, you asked for two, but there's a bacalhau recipe. Bacalhau. Have you ever had bacalhau? It's a Portuguese dish.
No, I have not.
Yeah, it's salted codfish. It's amazing. It's actually one of my, it's probably my favorite recipe in the book because it's a recipe that my mom used to make for me.
Mm.
And we're not Portuguese, but for some reason, my mom got into making this recipe for me. And I'm the only person in my family that ate fish. So she would make it expressly for me.
Mm.
And I would just like go to town on it. I would love when she would make this for me. So freaking good. And very, you know, all healthy fats, and bacalhau is salted codfish. It can easily be found at most supermarkets, and it's flaky and salty and loaded with protein. So delicious. And then there's like a dessert. There's a bunch of desserts, but in particular, I have this dessert dish that is it's dark chocolate covered fresh blueberries. So I provide I show people how to basically melt down chocolate, and you go and you get fresh blueberries from the store. I had never had these before. Like this is an OG recipe from the Genius Kitchen, but it combines two of my favorite Genius foods, blueberries and dark chocolate, and really easy to make. Takes about 20 minutes to make. It actually takes less than that. It takes 2 minutes to make, but you
heat the chocolate down,
heat the chocolate, and then you have to put them in the fridge. And they come out. Kids love them. They're amazing. I've tested the recipe with some friends that have kids, and it was a staple for me. I mean, I was like going overboard. Probably I was eating it like I was making this thing like every day. My brothers would come over, my friends would come over. They'd want these like chocolate covered blueberries because the blueberries explode in your mouth, right? But then they're underneath this like hard dark chocolate shell. So tasty.
I love it, man.
Yeah,
those are great. Maybe we can get one. You know, sometimes I know like authors do like. One recipe, it doesn't have to be one of those, but one recipe we can link to. It could be on your website. We'll include it in the show notes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
People can check out, you know, sample recipe. And the book is out. And what's the website for people to grab the book?
GeniusKitchenBook.com. You'll find links to all the different stores. If you live abroad, there's a link to Book Depository, which offers free worldwide shipping. So you can order from Book Depository or your favorite bookstore of choice. We've got all the different links at GeniusKitchenBook.com. But also it's available at all, or should be available at all independent bookstores. We love supporting local bookshops. It's on Amazon. It's, you know, it's on all the places. So pretty easy to find.
Amazing. And you got the podcast as well. Genius Life Podcast. We're actually recording this out of your studio. It's a great setup and space over there.
Thanks, man.
And so we'll link to that in the show notes. Max, a pleasure. Thanks for jamming out with me. We chatted for about 2 hours. I felt like we covered a lot of different topics. I really appreciate it.
I know. This was awesome. Always a pleasure. Grateful to call you, not just a collaborator, but one of my best friends. Thank you for being you. Just want to go on record saying that. Love you, man.
Love you too, brother.
Appreciate it.
Appreciate it.